View from Ukraine as Putin orders troops to the breakaway territories.
I didn't sleep all this night, honestly.
And a close read of Putin and Biden as Europe is poised for war. I'm Marco Werman. Also on the show, Colombia this week became the latest Latin American country to expand access to abortion.
We are not in favor of the abortion per se. We are in favor that each woman can make the best decisions that they need to do.
And healthcare as a human right. We reflect on the work of public health leader Paul Farmer.
Global health to him wasn't about care in the poorest parts of the world. It was the idea that everyone everywhere deserves health.
An especially poignant legacy as the pandemic drags into its third year. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Thank you for being with us. The Russian military is on the move, sending troops and combat vehicles into separatist regions of eastern Ukraine. What's different this time is that Russian President Vladimir Putin is recognizing the independence of the so-called Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics. In response, President Biden said this afternoon that what's happening now is the beginning of a Russian invasion of Ukraine. Biden also announced new sanctions.
And if Russia goes further with this invasion, we stand prepared to go further as with sanctions. Who in the Lord's name does Putin think gives him the right to declare new so-called countries on territory that belong to his neighbors? This is a flagrant violation of international law and demands a firm response from the international community.
For the latest, we're joined now by The World's Daniel Offman, who's been closely following these events. Daniel, over the past 24 hours, what have we seen from Russia?
Well, what's different now, Marco, is that Russia has signed this agreement with the so-called republics in Donetsk and Luhansk. This territory is part of Ukraine, but it's been a conflict zone since 2014. And now Russia has supported these separatists in the past, but now it's official and now Russian troops are on the ground. Today in a press conference, Putin went further.
Ну, мы же их признали. А это значит, мы признали все их фундаментальные документы в том.
What is Putin saying there, Daniel?
Well, he's saying that Russia considers the entire Donetsk and Luhansk region as separate from Ukraine. So he recognizes the larger territorial claims that the separatists are making in the region. Again, Marco, this is a conflict zone and Ukrainian forces are on the ground. But Putin didn't stop there. Let's take a listen.
Мы будем оказывать этим республикам соответствующую, в том числе, военную помощь.
Here he's saying that Russian forces will support the so-called Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics. And what's different is that in the past, Russia has tried to distance itself from showing this direct support to the separatists. But now lawmakers in Moscow gave the official green light for Russia to use force in the region. And also today, Russia announced that its embassy staff will be leaving Ukraine.
That is a big shift. So, Daniel, how have the U.S. and Europe responded to all of this?
So earlier today, Europe announced that it will sanction Russia. The EU outlined that it will target people and entities linked to this latest move. So that includes 351 members of Russia's parliament who voted for this recognition. Germany said that it's planning on halting the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project that would have brought Russian gas to Germany. And the Biden administration has characterized Russia's actions as an invasion, and it announced its own sanctions. Here's President Biden speaking today.
So today, I'm announcing the first tranche of sanctions to impose costs on Russia in response to their actions yesterday. These have been closely coordinated with our allies and partners, and will continue to escalate sanctions if Russia escalates. We're implementing full blocking sanctions on two large Russian financial institutions, VEB and their military bank.
So as you heard there, Marco, financial sanctions, but the Biden administration also is putting personal sanctions on Russian officials tied to this announcement. Biden confirmed the Nord Stream 2 move, and he also said that the U.S. will continue military assistance to Ukraine and also move U.S. troops to the Baltic countries. U.S. troops who are in Europe are going to move to Baltic countries near Russia.
So where does this leave Ukraine? And will this mean a further escalation and outright conflict?
Well, we can't get into the minds of Vladimir Putin, Russia's president. But what we can do is we could look at what he said and done recently. More than 150,000 troops are still near Ukraine's borders. Those troops don't seem to be going anywhere. And Putin has said directly that he does not see Ukraine as a real country. He's been clear that he said yesterday in his press conference that Ukraine is led by neo-Nazis. He said that what Ukraine is doing in eastern Ukraine is genocide. These are really stark statements, and it doesn't leave a lot of room for diplomacy. I think that what I must say is that a couple of weeks back, I was in Ukraine, and people there say they're ready to defend their country, and they will fight to the end, no matter what happens, no matter what Russia says or does.
The World's Daniel Hoffman, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
The past few hours have been excruciating for many residents of Kiev.
I didn't sleep all this night. Honestly.
That's former Ukrainian parliamentarian Hanna Hopko. Earlier today, we reached out to her in Kiev. I asked her what sort of future residents of Ukraine's capital are bracing for.
Putin will not stop after the recognition of Donetsk and Luhansk region and sending troops to temporary occupied Ukrainian territories. He needs more. And among the military options which are on the table, it's also direct airstrike on Kyiv, and actually to attack Kyiv from Belarusian side.
So in reaction to Putin's address yesterday, Ukraine's President Zelensky gave a video address to the people of Ukraine, but at 2 a.m. It did get replayed, but that is not a typical time for a president to get a big audience. What did you make of that? And does that kind of address calm people down or alarm them or confuse them?
It was important for our president this night to coordinate our response to Putin's new invasion with our key strategic partners like United States, also UK, European Parliament, NATO, Turkey. So this is why the president was busy in all these conversations. So for Ukraine, it's really important to see how our armed forces reacted. And our Minister of Defense, Mr. Reznikov, he made a very strong statement, actually calling to armed forces to be ready to defend our country, that mothers in Russia will understand that they will receive killed Russian sons who will dare to follow Putin's crazy decision to attack Ukraine again. So we are ready to defend our territorial integrity. Actually, we understand that we will pay prices, and I hope the West will send tougher sanctions and signal for Putin to stop him from his attack on Kyiv and grabbing new territories of Ukraine.
I mean, on so many fronts, though, Ukrainians are vastly outmatched in this conflict. We also hear your attitude from many Ukrainians that they are ready to fight against Russia, a country that has the largest conventional military in Europe. So how can Ukraine win a war with Russia?
Look, how within these 8 years of Russian ongoing military aggression, we stopped Putin, because in 2014, he planned to grab not just part of Donetsk and Luhansk region, but also Kharkiv region, Kherson Oblast, Odessa Oblast, to cut us from access to the Black Sea. So actually, our army stopped him. And now, Ukrainians, we will resist, and we are more trained, and our partners, compared to 2014, now they are saying the truth, that this is Russian military invasion. This is not internal conflict or Ukraine crisis. This is interstate war. And one day, I hope, Russia will be designated as an outlaw nation and a state sponsor of terrorism.
So, Hanna Hopko, what are you calling on the United States, the European Union, your other allies? What would you like them to do next?
Now we have to prevent the worst case scenario. So sanctioning international transaction of Russian ruble, cutting off Russia from the SWIFT system. So we initiated a campaign, Block Putin Wallets. So we published all names of Russian oligarchs. So we have to be tough. And thanks for halting Nord Stream 2. For good, it is great, but I hope this will be stopped forever, not like suspend. And of course, another important mechanism is to impose full-scale embargo on Russian oil and gas exports, because this is how dirty money, which fuels different terroristic acts, aggressive behavior of Kremlin, they're receiving this money. So I think it's really important. And another, what could be done also from the US side, to ask Google, YouTube, Facebook to open their offices in Kyiv in order to counter information security threats emanating from the moderation of social media content from Russia. Because now all the social networks, their offices are in Moscow, and they are moderating the content which are in Ukraine. So this is the weaponization of social media, which has to be stopped. And Estonia blocked Russian propaganda TV channels. So we have to stop Russian so-called media, because they are not a media, what we in democratic societies respect. This is just a rupors of Russian propaganda.
For you, Hannah, what is the worst case scenario?
One of them is direct rocket strikes on Kyiv, and also cyber attacks and rocket attacks on critical infrastructure, which will create chaos and blackout, no access to internet communication. And also we've seen that Russia produced this list of activists, political leaders, that they might, during the potential occupation, kill or repress. But of course, we are preparing for this. But look, I'm a mom of 11 years old daughter. And now, of course, it's very painful to see and to know that your colleagues might be killed, you might be killed, and others. So this is why we will not leave Ukraine, not leave Kyiv, because this is our land. And of course, we will fight until we win.
Hannah, if you don't mind me asking about your daughter, what are your concerns for her future right now?
Can we imagine that I could be potentially in this list to kill or to repress? Mm. So there are different media articles saying that Russians identified a list and they will kidnap some activists who are fighting with Kremlin and others. So my daughter is also reading all these articles. And I used to be for 5 years ahead of the Foreign Affairs Committee. So, of course, I generated transatlantic support to Ukraine. I drafted many resolutions calling upon our Western allies to recognize Russia as a state sponsor of terrorism. Also, personal sanctions against Putin and his oligarchs. So this is why for our children, it's just not about my daughter, this issue. It's about our children, because our kids was in these years. They are growing up in the environment when they hate Putin. For us, Ukrainians, it's not just to prevent the worst case scenario. It's in the Western interest to help us to win this battle and not to allow authoritarian regimes to extend their power. So this is like, it's about the future, all of us.
Hannah Hopko is a former member of Ukraine's parliament, where she headed its foreign affairs committee. She's been speaking with us from Kyiv. Hannah, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Yeah.
We will continue to follow the Ukraine-Russia story as it evolves. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. This week, Colombia became the latest country in Latin America to expand access to abortion. The country's highest court voted Monday to make the procedure legal until the 24th week of pregnancy. Manuel Rueda reports from Bogota.
Outside Colombia's constitutional court, hundreds of women jumped up and cheered as the tribunal of 9 judges voted to lift limits on abortion. The activists wore green scarves that have become a symbol of Latin America's feminist movement and shouted out that they defended a just cause. Until recently, abortions were only allowed in Colombia if a woman could prove to her healthcare provider that her pregnancy was a result of rape, or if the doctors determined the fetus had no chance of survival, or if carrying out the pregnancy put the mother's health at risk. The ruling on Monday by the country's highest court says that women can now get abortions until the 24th week, or about 6 months of pregnancy, without having to provide any justifications. Rights groups say that it'll improve access to abortion, especially in poor and rural communities, where women often get risky clandestine abortions. Catalina Martinez is the Latin America director for the Center for Reproductive Rights.
This has a very important impact on women's lives. This is a decision that recognizes women know what is best for them and their lives. We are not in favor of the abortion per se. We are in favor that each woman, adolescent and girls, can make the best decisions that they need to do on their lives and bodies.
Monday's ruling was 2 years in the making, and it came about thanks to a lawsuit filed by the Center for Reproductive Rights and four more organizations at the Constitutional Court. Now, Colombia is one of the countries in Latin America with the most flexible abortion laws. In Argentina, abortion is allowed without any justification until week 12 of pregnancy, and can still happen afterwards, but only under certain conditions. In Mexico, the Supreme Court recently ruled that women cannot face criminal charges for getting an abortion. Most countries in the region, however, still limit abortion to rape cases, while others, like El Salvador, have banned it altogether. But human rights groups say that courts around Latin America are increasingly inclined to take the Colombian path, because they have realized that threatening women with prison time is only increasing the number of clandestine abortions and other health problems. Jimena Casas researches women's rights in Latin America at Human Rights Watch.
When you have a state that is assuring the access, the real access to this service, most of the abortions happen in the first trimester. More than 90% are happening before the 14 weeks. So the whole point here is to assure the access, and that's why we're seeing that now the conversation is moving towards that way.
Abortion remains a controversial topic in Colombia, where a majority of the population identifies as Roman Catholic. Following Monday's ruling, anti-abortion groups mounted their own protest outside the Constitutional Court. Maribel Camacho is an activist for 40 Days for Life. For us, life begins at conception, she says. So who defends the rights of these babies who are still in their mother's wombs? They have equal rights as well. In Colombia, abortion can still be a criminal offense after the 24th week of pregnancy, punishable with up to 3 years of prison. Women's rights groups say that they'll continue to fight that, while anti-abortion groups have said that they will now turn to Colombia's Congress to seek more limits on the practice. For The World, I'm Manuel Rueda in Bogotá.
You've probably noticed by now that today's date is, frankly, really cool and unforgettable. 2/22/22, and it is a Tuesday, so numerically, even homophonically, the universe is in alignment. If you're into this kind of thing, I hope you found a way to celebrate. Lots of people have, from Singapore to Sacramento, couples have planned their weddings for this day. Others are proposing. Some couples hope or are planning to give birth today, giving their kid a pretty great birth date. We were curious why these kinds of dates mean so much to us, so we asked Barry Markovsky onto the show. He's a sociologist and professor emeritus at the University of South Carolina. Professor, your research looks into why we humans are so into these patterns, these numerological patterns, like today's date. What have you found?
Well, I'm not a numerologist. I want to make that really clear right up front. But I'm fascinated more generally in why we see patterns and how seeing patterns sometimes ramps up into some kind of collective behavior like we're seeing today. Socially, you know, we often make meanings out of things that are inherently meaningless. And the reasons we do this are really what fascinate me, because they're life and death judgments that we make. So being able to recognize patterns in the weather, in predators when we're in a hunter-gatherer society. These are things that we depend on for life.
I mean, back when we were all hunter-gatherers, detecting animal prints was a way of knowing danger might be around the corner. Many of us are not walking down the sidewalk these days looking for paw prints. But in the modern world, are there ways that pattern recognition helps us?
Sure. Anything that you can connect to food, clothing, and shelter, even today, involves some kind of pattern recognition. It's simplistic in a way, but, you know, I open the refrigerator door, I see food. Well, that's a very primitive kind of pattern, and I depend on it.
Right. So what would be like the benefit for you? Can you imagine the benefit of 2/22/22 having some real significance?
Well, the significance of a date like that really is what we make of it culturally. And I'm a little surprised that beyond just noticing the pattern, there do seem to be some collective behaviors that have emerged. People are getting married on this date. The hotels are offering special deals for $222 a night, that sort of thing. I can't say that there's anything of cosmic significance associated with it. I mean, I would like to see National Margarita Day instituted. That happens to be today as well.
You take this quite soberly. And I'm just wondering if you ever find yourself kind of slipping into the number pattern and applying meaning.
I am human. I can't avoid it. Absolutely. I was actually on a long drive and it happened to be February 4th. And I just suddenly realized, oh, 2222 had just passed and I didn't even notice it. And I started to think about other patterns. My own birthday, it turns out if I had been born just 30 days sooner, it would have been 3456. Yeah. And if I had been born 35 years sooner, it would have been 4321.
So are you celebrating 2222 yourself? And will it involve a margarita?
I am hoping so. That's the tentative plan right now.
Sociologist Barry Markowski, thank you very much and a very happy Tuesday to you.
Same to you, Marco.
You can read more about why number patterns like 2222 have been fascinating people for over 2,000 years. That story, along with how U.S. sailors helped launch Barcelona's tourism industry in the 1950s, all on our website, theworld.org. Marco here. We were blown away by the support we received during our 2021 fundraiser. Over 775 listeners made donations to support The World. Here are just a few of those supporters. Michelle Rodolph, Matt Rohr, Vincent Saito, Linda Samuels, Jane Schmitz, Michelle Sagers, Elizabeth Schaefer, Tony Shuga, Brenda Silver, Ailey Slater. While I'm not able to individually thank each person who donated, know that here at The World, we are forever grateful for every single person who listens to the show. Musicians draw inspiration from all kinds of sources: love, heartache, Japanese ghosts.
If her head is just floating above water, she just looks like a beautiful woman, but she's this villainous creature that completely holds her own.
That creature goes by the name Nure Onna. We have the song That Fearsome Spirit Inspired coming up in this half hour on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. This week, account details from the Swiss bank Credit Suisse were leaked and published. They unmasked account holders linked to illegal or illicit activities involving more than $100 billion parked at Credit Suisse. The leak was first shared with the German newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung and then with a consortium of media outlets. News reports are looking at tens of thousands of accounts linked to people engaged in drug trafficking, money laundering, and corruption. Dominic Gross is a tax and finance analyst at Switzerland's global development think tank, Allianz Sud. He joins us from Zurich. So after multiple disclosures over recent years of similar activities, the Paradise Papers, Pandora Papers, Panama Papers, what stands out for you in this leak?
I mean, the weeks in the last few years through were mainly a collection where a lot of different banks and law firms and so on were involved. So this is in a way special that it's only about a Swiss bank, but the structures, the offshore structures behind it, which Switzerland is an important player in, are not different from other leaks, actually.
Can you give us a few examples of some of the account holders revealed in this leak and what they were actually involved in?
It's obvious that the Credit Suisse has strong ties to the so-called Bobo elite. Credit Suisse has traditionally a close relation to the elite in Venezuela. So this is actually something, a specific character of these leaks. And then Egypt is also involved, which is politically very interesting also in the context of the Egyptian revolution in 2011. So you see that the Credit Suisse has clients in Egypt who were actually on the side of the old powers in Egypt and also on the side of the new powers. So in general, you see that, Swiss banks are maybe not the ones who are actually usually on the side of the people and the people who are actually trying to make their countries more democratic or open and free. It's obviously the opposite.
So financial watchdogs know that sheltering millions and billions, it's a problem globally. What do the revelations tell us about the system in place that's supposed to detect money laundering at banks?
Tells us that there are still too many loopholes. I mean, and that these loopholes or this kind of way of doing banking is going back way to the 40s and even back to the 19th century, maybe. It's a very complicated kind of structure which is at work here. It's not only about banks, it's also lawyers who are providing trusts or providing family offices for the super rich and then link that together with letterboxes, for example, in Panama or so, and then at the end you got a bank account in Switzerland. As long as some loopholes are open around the world, the money will always flow exactly there.
How has Switzerland tried to fix this in the past? And with this attention after a lot of revelations and now the Credit Suisse revelations, is there now a focus on enforcement?
The problem is that the people in Parliament, for example, who are fighting for more transparency and more decent due diligence regulations when it comes to money laundering, for example, are in a minority. So it's actually very hard to put things forward in a way which is not just like fulfilling the absolute minimum of the international standards. And this is obviously not enough. This is also something which you can read in these leaks.
So, Dominic, what do you expect to happen now in Switzerland after these revelations about Credit Suisse?
Maybe we will see progress when it comes to the possibility for medias to write about this stuff. A case that in Switzerland, like only like 6 years ago, a new part of the Banking Act was introduced saying that journalists can't speak about data which was leaked in the context of the Swiss banking secrecy. So I would be quite optimistic that at least that we could change. But that doesn't mean, for example, that we get a better whistleblower legislation.
Dominic Gross, he's a tax and finance analyst at Switzerland's global development think tank Allianz Sud. He's in Zurich. Dominic, thank you for your insights. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Indonesia has the largest Muslim population in the world, but the country also has diverse religious communities, including a very small Jewish one, just a few hundred people. One Indonesian man recently tried to spread awareness of anti-Semitism and its dangers, but that brought him a lot of trouble, including allegations that he's pushing a secret political agenda. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
If you look at his ID card, it says Mr. Yaakov Baruch is Christian. Which is pretty strange, because not only is he Jewish, he's a rabbi. I asked him, does that bother you?
Of course, for sure.
In Indonesia, every citizen has to identify with one of six official religions. There's Muslim, they make up almost 90% of the population. Then there's Hindu, Confucian, Buddhist, Protestant, and Catholic. Judaism isn't on the list, so Jewish people have to go with something else.
So they who live in the Christian area, they put Christian, and other Jews who live in the Muslim area, they put Muslim.
Rabbi Baruch lives in a city on Sulawesi Island with many Christians around, so he went with Christian. Being Jewish in Indonesia can be tough. Anti-Semitism is pretty out in the open. On social media, some people post Nazi images, thinking they look cool. The rabbi says very few people in Indonesia ever meet Jews, so they're susceptible to dangerous ideas. Even idolizing Adolf Hitler.
There is something wrong with this phenomenon, you know. Hitler is a bad guy. He's not a hero.
About 2 weeks ago, Baruch set up a Holocaust memorial in his synagogue, the only synagogue in the whole country. The exhibit is mostly black and white photos, nothing grandiose. He paid for it himself. It really wasn't a huge deal, until the media found out.
Museum Holocaust ini merupakan yang pertama di Indonesia.
It's a recent TV news story on Baruch's memorial. Powerful figures in Indonesia accused the rabbi of having a secret agenda backed by Israel, a country Indonesia does not recognize. Indonesia's top council of Islamic clerics, a religious body that advises the government, said this memorial is divisive and that it should close. One leader on the council said that all Jewish people everywhere should focus on, quote, Israeli Zionists and their brutal treatment of the Palestinians. But Rabbi Baruch says this memorial has nothing to do with Israel.
The Indonesian people still cannot separate between a Jew and Israel. They talk all Jews are Israeli.
Rabbi Baruch isn't Israeli at all, but he says he did lose relatives in the Holocaust. Ethnically, he's mixed Indonesian and Dutch, and his Dutch side came to the Indonesian tropics a long time ago, when Indonesia was still a Dutch colony. He says he just wants to run his synagogue for the small number of Jewish people in his coastal town. That's it.
We only want to practice Judaism. We don't want to involve in any politics, you know.
But the conspiracy theories keep coming. Some say the rabbi is part of a plot linked to America. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken recently came to Indonesia and urged the government to recognize Israel as a country, to which the government said that won't happen until Palestine is liberated. Again, the rabbi says, I don't know anything about that. I'm not trying to change the policy of Indonesia.
I'm a normal person. I'm not involved in politics.
All this negative attention is coming from clerics and their followers who don't know Rabbi Baruch. He says on the island of Sulawesi, where he lives, everyone is really supportive, especially Muslims, including imams. He says locals like the memorial, and they say don't shut it down. So he's going to keep it open.
It's important for us to fight all the hatred and racism. Otherwise, we can face another Holocaust.
And to his Muslim friends, he says, whenever you need help fighting Islamophobia, I've got your back.
Zero tolerance to the hatred and racism. Just because I'm Jewish, I want to start with the anti-Semitism, then we will fight the rest.
But start with anti-Semitism, he says, and then we will fight other kinds of hatred. For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
The death of global health pioneer Dr. Paul Farmer is being felt around the globe. Farmer is credited with building community health systems for some of the world's poorest people in Haiti, Rwanda, and here in the U.S. That was through his work as co-founder of the nonprofit Partners in Health. Farmer died yesterday of a heart attack at one of the hospitals in Rwanda he helped create. Here he is in 2017 from a video posted by Partners in Health.
It's really everybody's responsibility to think about health equity, you know, and whether you're looking at some place like Philadelphia or Boston or rural Arkansas, those places are on the globe too. So this is not about, you know, saving the world by going off to some far off place. This is about saving the world by thinking about equity and about social justice in general.
Dr. Atul Gawande has known Paul Farmer since they were both medical residents at Harvard in the 1990s. Gawande is head of global health at USAID and joins us from Nigeria's capital, Abuja. Dr. Gawande, how did you meet Paul Farmer and what drew you together initially?
We first met as trainees in Boston at the Brigham Women's Hospital. I was in surgery. He was in infectious disease. And first of all, just as a physician, he was phenomenal because every patient was important. He was unbelievably generous. If you were part of the world trying to make care better, he had time. And, you know, what he said in that clip, global health to him wasn't about care in the poorest parts of the world. It was the idea that everyone everywhere deserves health.
Let's talk about the state of global health when you first met Farmer. I understand that one of your predecessors at USAID thought that back in the day, poor patients could not be relied on to even take medication on time.
Yeah, I'm occupying the seat of the person in the U.S. government who testified before Congress to say that HIV treatments just were not feasible for people who lived in the low and middle income world, places where millions of people were infected with HIV. And he'd say, people don't have watches and they don't know how to use clocks and they won't take their medicines on time and they're too expensive anyway. And Paul was in Haiti building clinics that were showing it that was just wrong. And he built the moral framework that we all are pursuing in global health, saying that we all deserve this capability and we just got to figure out how to make it happen.
Paul Farmer, I mean, he built these community systems from the ground up to create better healthcare for everyone. He had proof of concept. Specifically, how did he do that?
Well, he did it by living there. You know, he took on becoming a member of the village in Haiti where he built his first clinic. He moved to Rwanda. He became a dual citizen of Rwanda and the U.S. Wow. He made himself part of these communities to say that his life was as much at stake with them as anybody else's. And then he built with these communities. He was forever on planes. He'd be on duty at the Brigham in Boston. And as soon as he could be off duty, he'd find a way to hop on a plane to get to Haiti and be in the village. He brought communities together to say, we are going to build whatever the world around us, however poor, I will bring resources and let us build together. He would train people, everybody in the community, how to be a community health worker, ultimately opened nursing schools, medical schools, built hospitals, an entire system across multiple countries that ranged from reservations for the Native Americans to the homeless in Boston to people with TB in Russia, and of course what he did in Rwanda and Haiti.
So do you feel like farmers' work changed global health as we know it? I mean, was the discipline that he kind of pursued, did it exist before you were studying medicine at Harvard?
When we were first having those conversations, there was no pathway for people like him, people with the kind of desires I had. And, you know, he gave us the moral framework that grounded us in what we're doing in global health. And then he gave us the technical tools. How do you deliver HIV care in the poorest environments? What has to change about how the medicines are made, about how they're distributed, about what the jobs of people are? He showed how you could take drug-resistant TB and directly observe people taking their medicines and successfully treat it. And just, you know, the technical work of how do you make this happen? And then he created the training programs. And that goes beyond anything I know of people doing at such scale and with such impact.
Now we're in the midst of a pandemic, and some of those inequities farmers spotted years ago are now laid bare for everyone to see. How would you characterize this moment in global health, and what can be learned from farmers' legacy on what still needs doing?
At core, what COVID has shown us is a principle that has been apparent a long time, which is that we've been all breakthrough and not enough follow through. And COVID is a beautiful example. The vaccines are an incredible breakthrough, but if they are not provided in ways that can reach everybody everywhere, we will all suffer from the next variant, the next surge. And, you know, I'm here on behalf of USAID announcing and implementing programs that are going to build so that we don't have just 12% of Africans getting fully vaccinated, but that they can achieve and deserve to have the same opportunity at vaccination that we are achieving elsewhere in the world. And it will be crucial to the well-being of every one of us.
Is there a particular memory of Paul Farmer that you've been reflecting on?
What you don't necessarily see and remember about Paul, this is the most radical, anti-institutional standard bearer you can imagine. And he was the most joyous, happy, mischievous. You know, there was never an angry bone in his body. And it's hard to convey what it's like 2 a.m, you're sitting in front of a patient and he's ribbing you and joking with you and being super serious about the fact that we're going to take care of this person. We're going to do it right. And we can think about the world and the way everybody can be treated this way too.
It seems at first a terrible irony that he died in one of the hospitals he helped build, that one in Rwanda, or maybe you see that as profoundly symbolic.
It is where his heart, all too literally, is and was. I can't believe I'm saying was. He's 62. I mean, it's just gutting, I have to say, but that is where he needed to be.
Dr. Atul Gawande is head of global health at USAID. He spoke with us from Abuja, Nigeria, about his friend and former colleague, Paul Farmer. Thank you very much for helping us remember Dr. Farmer.
Thank you.
I was drawn to our next guest, not necessarily because I have my ear to the ground of the current indie rock scene, but I do have an abiding interest in the world of Japanese ghosts. And Sasami Ashworth, who goes just by Sasami, has taken a dive into that world as she was making the music on her second studio album titled Squeeze. A lot of the songs on it are inspired in part by Japanese spirit folklore, or yokai.
I'm not afraid to die.
Sasami joins me now. I want you to explain yokai in a moment and this one Japanese spirit that you were drawn to especially. But rewind a bit. You actually discovered this spirit world as you dug into your own family story. You were born in L.A., and on your mother's side, you're descended from the Zainichi people. Who are they?
Yeah, I think just, you know, being a living, breathing human in 2020, it's very natural that we were all going very deep in our personal family heritage. And I think growing up as like an Asian American in a mostly white neighborhood, I kind of was growing up just so focused on like trying to assimilate into American culture. But as I'm getting older, I'm kind of more curious about my family's history. So during the pandemic, I had bought a bunch of books on the Zainichi culture. So my family is two generations, my mom and my grandma. They were born in Japan, but are ethnically Korean. And they're a group of people during the Japanese occupation of Korea who went to Japan for more opportunities and chances for prosperity.
So how do the Zainichi think of themselves today? Are they Japanese or Korean?
I think there's kind of a split culturally. Some people have kind of assimilated more into Japanese culture, like my late uncle, Takeshi Hirota. He went by his Japanese name, and he was actually a Japanese, he was an anime creator and director and producer, whereas like my aunt moved to Korea and goes by a Korean name and married a Korean man. And there are a lot of Zainichi people in Japan who are very proud of their Korean heritage after like decades of shame.
So today, where do the Zainichi live? Like how widespread are they? And what are their experiences as a group that it sounds like they're in a minority?
Yeah, I mean, I think in, you know, the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, Korean Zainichi people who lived in Japan were living in slums and were extremely ostracized. But now they're kind of living just amongst everyone. And there's a lot more acceptance of Zainichi culture. And I think before, some Zainichi people were completely stateless. They didn't have citizenship in Japan or Korea. And now I think it's kind of a choice if you want to be repatriated to Korea or join Japanese society legally.
Mm. Have you visited this part of the world?
I visited Japan and Korea, but not as an adult, just as a kid.
Mm. Do you remember any impressions that you took away of the lives of the Zainichi you met?
As a kid, you don't really question the historical relevance of your family culture. You just kind of accept everything as it is. And I grew up with such a mixed Korean and Japanese heritage that I didn't even really think to sort out what was Japanese and what was Korean.
It's all really fascinating. Let's go back to the yokai, this world of Japanese spirits that you discovered. I mean, it's a really wild world with many ghosts, each with a particular role and job. One in particular, Nure Onna, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, a spirit of the water world. Explain who
yes.
she is. And Nure Onna, is it a she? Is that right?
Yes, Nure Onna is a yokai character that has a woman's head and a snake body. And they're a water-dwelling creature that washes their hair. And, you know, like all folk tales, there's kind of different tellings of it. But the one that I think about the most, she's washing her hair in either the river or the ocean, and some sailors come and bother her, and she hands them a bundle that looks like a baby. And my interpretation of it is that it's kind of this test of morality. And if the sailors or whoever passes by decides to discard the bundle, it turns into a rock, which weighs them down and drowns them. And then she sucks their blood.
Wow. Some of the old Japanese prints of Nure Onna are seriously scary. I mean, she's got this bright red tongue. What drew you to Nure Onna in particular?
Yeah, I just made my sophomore album called Squeeze, which comes out on February 25th. And it's kind of playing with all these duplicities of beauty and horror, kind of harmony and dissonance and harshness. And I was really attracted to the duplicity of Nure Onna and how she is from the surface. Like if her head is just floating above water, she just looks like a beautiful woman. But she's the furthest thing from a victim, which is kind of the more historical tale of a femme character. She's this villainous creature that it completely holds her own. And in my projection onto her, she also has this kind of morality that I find to be fascinating and beautiful.
One one of your collaborators compared you to a satanic Brian Wilson. I mean, it starts to all make sense now with this Nirvana connection. I don't want to get literal and impose meaning on your music, but the track Feminine Water Turmoil, was Nirvana the starting point?
Yeah, so when I was finishing my album, that was one of the last songs. I had already began to collaborate with Andrew Thomas Wang, who did the cover art. And he's a really incredible artist. He's worked with Björk and FKA Twigs, and he's a Chinese-American, also from Southern California, and he does a lot of work with Chinese deities and Chinese folktale characters. So we really bonded over this Nirvana character, and so I kind of wanted to make one piece that was a bit of an ode to Andrew and our collaboration and an ode to Nirvana. And also, it's kind of a track that connects the last song, which is about nature, with the rest of the album, which is kind of about human nature. And so I wanted to have a mercurial kind of floating feel.
Right. So it then transitions into Not a Love Song. That's the last track on the album, which is also really beautiful.
I could hear a song ringing in my ears, so I wrote it down for my love to hear.
Sasami's new album is called Squeeze. Thank you very much for sharing your story with us.
Oh my gosh, my pleasure.
It brought me to my knees and took my breath away.
From Sasami to new music from Jamaica and traditional Indian music, we got your music cravings covered. We have a playlist with tunes from artists we have featured on the show so far this year. Find a link to it on our Twitter feed. We are at The World. And that is our show today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe and stay strong. We'll see you right back here again tomorrow.